Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Once again, we have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program. Today, we have a very interesting topic when we see all the changes that are taking place in the world and also taking place here in this country. And our discussion and our topic today, why Americans need a second revolution. And Alan, once again, I'd like to welcome you to the program.
Well, thanks for having me again, Stuart.
Well, Alan, you always make this show so very interesting. A lot of people, they look forward to having you to come on and join the program every week. People ask on a frequent basis, how can I tune into this program, or where's the links? And eventually people start following the program. And I just want to thank you for all that you do and all that you add to this program. Thanks again. Alan, as I mentioned, for 5 years, millions of Americans have been waiting for Obama's revolution, and we can see that that was a revolution that never happened. We saw Obama making all sorts of promises and the Democrats making promises in 2007 and 2008, how they were going to create jobs, how they were going to have massive infrastructure projects. They were going to put millions of Americans back to work. They were going to have incomes moving away from the poverty wages, how they were going to have increased wages for many of the working class people. Alan, where did that revolution that was promised by the Obama group, where did they go wrong? Because none of it has happened.
Well, I think people got sucked into a great big hoax is what it amounts to. And people really believed and had confidence that Obama was going to begin to change things and go in the opposite direction of where Wall Street was taking this country. And Obama misled people into believing this. And many of the people, especially many of these people that are very liberal-minded people, progressive-minded people, but especially the left wing, some of these people played a very sinister role in making people believe that Obama was something that he never was, and that they tried to make people believe that he was progressive, and Obama has never been progressive. He's always been a very conservative, neoliberal politician, not unlike any of these other politicians. Ronald Reagan or any of these other people, in my opinion, he's probably more conservative and right-wing than Richard Nixon. You know, he may not be as corrupt and crooked as Richard Nixon, although we haven't, seen everything that's been going on in his White House. But sure, he's just as conservative and right-wing as any of these other presidents. It's my opinion personally that what we're going to be seeing from now on is every president is going to be worse than the president before. And that's because the capitalist system itself, it's rotten to the core. And to some people, it still looks like it's a nice red apple, but the core is rotting. And it's like you look at an apple that looks real nice and you pick it up and it just squishes in your hands because there's nothing in it. And so these presidents and these politicians are trying to hold the system together. And it's just a rotten system. It breeds war, poverty, racism.
Well, part of what he was talking about in this revolution, that basically he was talking about revolutionary ideas. He was going to have transparency in government. And, you know, we haven't seen that in government, not in my lifetime. He was going to move us from a wartime economy to a peacetime economy, creating jobs, and he was going to end those wars overseas, and he was going to close down military bases. We have opened up more military bases. We have sucked more people into this war economy. And everything that he's promised in regards to transparency, creating jobs, closing Guantanamo, ending the wars, closing bases. None of that has happened. Those were the revolutionary ideas that Americans and working people were expecting when he took office in 2009. And Alan, none of it, I can't think of anything, none of it has happened. If you can comment on that, and then we're going to talk about how he was going to revolutionize healthcare. It's been a complete disaster. But could you speak about the transparency, ending the wars, closing Guantanamo, what people were expecting in that phase of his revolution?
Well, in that aspect, too, none of this has happened. If anything, it's gotten worse than what it was under George Bush. You know, instead of him putting people in prison in Guantanamo, he's killing them with drones to evade completely any kind of justice whatsoever. And instead of putting these people in Guantanamo and holding them as prisoners, as bad as it is, he's literally assassinating these people and murdering them. And
exactly.
You know, this is worse than what it was under Bush. Bush did drone killings, but Obama has increased them. And you can go right down the line. Obama promised all kinds of things, and people actually thought Obama was going to help the common people, Main Street, I guess many people call it, that he was going to help Main Street. Instead, he went ahead and he helped Wall Street. And the speed with which he did this makes us realize, I think, that these were all lies that Obama was talking about and those that supported him. And it was a very slick campaign. I don't think we've ever seen anything like it in this country. And probably the next campaign is going to even be slicker and more lies, more jingoism, more national chauvinism, you know, more imperialist support for imperialist wars. It's a terrible situation that we're in. And the only thing we can do is begin to organize to fight back. And I see a lot of people now beginning to fight back. The news media isn't reporting it, but it's going on across the country. People are just totally pissed off about everything that's going on in this country. And you see protesting against these environmental disasters and everything that we're being subjected to. And, you know, every thing that's going on, peace demonstrations all over the place. When I drive around Minnesota, I see people out on street corners holding up signs in little communities where you'd never expect people to be holding these little vigils and stuff. And so people are speaking out. The media, if you listen to the media, we don't hear anything about it. You know,
no,
so
you don't.
People
got
to begin to connect. No, people got to begin to create their own media, whether it's the social media, which they can shut down. People should be aware of that. People should be in touch with each other. We need to start holding conferences and forums where we can have a meeting of the minds and, you know, bring all these diverse groups of people on that are liberals, progressives, and leftists that are beginning to understand what's going on. We got to bring these people together to bring forward some specific solutions to the problems that we're facing and mobilize people around those solutions. That's my opinion.
Well, two other things that he had talked about. He had talked about revolutionizing healthcare, where he was going to make certain that healthcare was affordable and healthcare was going to be available to all. Alan, that has been a complete disaster. What happened to that phase of the revolution, Obama's revolution? Because now we have people cannot afford health care. We have the Internal Revenue Service breathing down their neck within the next few months if they are not paying for what they're supposed to be getting from this Obamacare with various penalties, and, of course, it will be plaguing them. But what happened to health care, being able to have – keep your own doctors, affordable health care for all. That's one of the bigger parts of the lies that were produced back around 2009 and 2010. And now that's, you know, he has the complete entire nation angry on this one.
Right. It's probably the biggest lie of all that he and those supporting him ever told. Obama, I have videos. People can look it up themselves. All they have to do is Google Obama and single-payer universal health care. and you will find videos of Obama explicitly stating that he is for single-payer universal health care like they have in Canada. That's his own words.
Right.
And he never was for that, but he talked about that when he was trying to get the nomination in the first place. And he did this in many, many places. So people believed he was somebody for single-payer universal health care like they have in Canada, and it turned out to be a total lie. We saw what he did with that, when doctors came forward and wanted to testify and stuff in Congress and before the Senate, they had those people, doctors, arrested.
Right.
This is not only an attack on with health care, it was an attack on democracy itself, and it's been going downhill ever since. And people are going to have to learn, they're going to have to state what they actually want in this country, and they're going to have to start electing politicians and working for politicians that support those kinds of solutions to problems. There's no other way about it. We can't expect the Obamas of this world or any of the Democrats or Republicans to stand up for anything in this country, for sure not the Republicans. And the Democrats, if they haven't been totally opposed to really solving the problems of the people, they've acquiesced to Obama right down the line. And, their opposition is weak at best. There might be a handful of people in Congress that have sort of stood up and said, we need something other than what people have been forced down their throats with Obamacare and everything. But unless we take an alternative route on this, we're in a heck of a shape. People are paying more for health care now than they ever did.
Yeah, they are. Everyone. I mean, it's gone up across the board.
Yeah.
So one of the other things that we had to consider is education. Obama was talking about part of his revolution back in 2007 and 2008, the revolutionary changes that he was going to bring to this country. He felt that we needed to maintain the highest levels of education in this world and in this nation, and also that education should be affordable for people that wanted to pursue higher learning. But that is also the quality of education in this country, Alan, is in the toilet. And we see now the student debts are not only on the increase, but they're well over $1.1 trillion, and there's no forgiveness by this Congress. Where did Obama go wrong on that one? I mean, he has gone back on his promise with millions and millions of students across his country.
This is one of the things that is really hard to comprehend, education, because his attacks on teachers and public education began almost from the first day he took office, and yet we have the teacher unions supporting Obama. They supported him a second time around, even after him and Rahm Emanuel joined in attacking teachers in Chicago. And this is really sort of bizarre. But these leaders of these unions that forced these candidates down people's throats, they never allowed a real debate or discussion as to whether they wanted whether the members wanted to support Obama or not. And
right.
This is one of the problems. And people are going to have to start to speak up. And especially in the unions, there's going to have to be some kind of rank-and-file organization that takes shape in order to overcome what's going on. But Obama started his attacks on education almost from the first day he came in by attacking teachers and started talking about teachers that aren't doing their job. Well, the teachers aren't being allowed to do their jobs by administrations and politicians that are cutting back every aspect of education when it comes to teachers being able to teach students. And then we're seeing the textbooks. All these textbooks they have to be approved in Texas and by this commission and everything. This is, what are students learning in school? They're learning everything that's, they're learning a bunch of lies that Wall Street wants them to hear. That, students in school, they'll give you the most bizarre answers when you ask them questions about history or social studies. Basic things like reading. There's no reason there should be a problem teaching kids to read We've been teaching people to read for centuries, and there's no real secret to teaching a human being how to read, and yet somehow they've created a situation where there's a problem teaching kids how to read and even how to write. You know, it's almost like, you know, that they've put effort, they've expended a whole lot of money trying to sabotage the system is what it amounts to. They want to sabotage public education, and they want to privatize public education after they sabotage it. And I think this is the whole thing of what's wrong in the direction that Obama is going, this whole thing with charter schools. You know, he wants to give support to these private charter schools. This is undermining public education. You know, you can just go right down his whole agenda, and it's all about privatizing everything. And people attribute that usually to the Republicans, but it's the Democrats that are doing the exact same thing, and it's being led by Obama. You know, what can we say? He's sabotaging everything in the public sphere, from public education to taking care of the roads. You know, they're wasting money on militarism and wars instead of putting that money into education. It's really absurd to even think that we shouldn't just write off these loans that students owe for education when we're spending all this money on militarism and wars. You know, think about it. What kind of priorities does this country have? It's the country is just totally lost as far as, the direction we're heading.
You know, the only revolution I see that has taken place has been the completing the revolution that was started by Wall Street. And under the Obama administration, they have completely taken over. Once again, I just want to mention that we have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program once again. Yeah, he comes on our program every other week. Alan is a political analyst and also social activist, been very involved in the movement to protect the rights of workers for the most greater part of his life. And Alan, once again, I want to thank you for joining the program.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be on.
You know, Alan, I find it very interesting when we began doing this program a year and a half ago, people would come on the line from time to time, and they would come into the program so they could stand in defense of Obama and his administration. And all of those individuals, they're running for cover now. No one comes on the line and says anything in defense of Obama. I guess they know that they're going to go down in flames. And Alan, you've encountered a few of them.
That's the other thing, Stuart, that's really out of kilter and wrong. None of these people that are supporting Obama, none of them will come and have a face-to-face debate with anybody that's opposed to Obama from the left. They will talk with people on the right, but they will never talk with people on the left to discuss these issues. They want to pretend that there is no opposition to Obama from liberals, progressives, and leftists. And there's massive opposition. If you look at the polls, the majority of the people that are polled take very progressive stands on the issues. There is, a complete contradiction to everything that Obama has done and stood for. And yet, they will not, if you look at anything on television or listen on the radio to any of these programs, you'd think there's no opposition from liberals, progressives, and leftists to Obama, you know.
Right.
And, and part of that is because we haven't really pushed our way into the public square to state our positions. I know I'm always trying to get people to write letters to the editor and to, do things like tabling like we used to do, years ago. And, things like this. This is the way we have to bring our views into the public square for the American people to consider. But what's happening is too many people are talking among themselves, people that agree, and we're not getting out to the public with our ideas. That's why I welcome programs like this. I talk to people and they pass on the link to some of Obama's supporters and stuff, and so they have an opportunity to listen. I had a lady contact me just this week. And she said she listened to our program last week, and she said, we raised issues in a way that she had never thought about these problems before. She said she had been a solid Obama supporter, and she's finally beginning to look at things a little differently. And I think that more and more, when people hear the alternative views, they're going to, you know, begin to consider, you know, are the Democrats really worth working for and voting for, or do
they need
a new political party?
Well, it's not difficult to determine if a person is telling a lie. It's not difficult to determine if the administration is telling a lie. When someone promised you something and they don't deliver, you know, that's kind of, is clear cut. So, and that's what people are starting to see. You know, did he deliver or didn't he? And if he didn't deliver, it's a lie. You know, that's pretty simple.
I think one of the problems is, though, Stuart, is that Obama was real slick when he first started out seeking the nomination. And he did it from a populist position, and people really believed he was sincere. He was going to help the common people. And what he did is he went out and got all these people to make small donations, $5 a month, $10 a month, contributions to his campaign. And when people make a financial contribution to some politician, they never want to really that politician and say, hey, I made a mistake. They think they've got an investment in that person, and at some point they're really going to come forward and take care of their problems. And I think that's kind of what we're dealing with right now, that people just aren't willing to admit that they were wrong. And we've seen this in the past. I mean, we saw this with Richard Nixon. I can remember that back, you know, when Richard Nixon was facing impeachment. A lot of these very moderate Republicans would stand by him, but as soon as the facts started to come out, they started to think, geez, what did we do with this guy? And finally, many of these Republicans and you know, even members of Congress and U.S. senators that were Republicans, they joined the movement to impeach Nixon. But it was a process, and it took time. And I think that's what we're facing right now with Obama. But Obama has run the slickest campaign in American history, probably in world history. I don't think anybody has ever done a better job of spreading on the lies. Even Hitler and what he did, hoodwinking the German people, was not as successful as Obama has been.
Right.
And this is what we have to confront.
I want to talk to you about, there's many different ways that you can look at revolution. And if you look at many people on the left, they think that we should have revolution more like a violent revolution. But revolution, it doesn't always mean that there's going to be violence to bring about the end results. Because what we have seen, what has taken place in the last 5 years, whether you want to admit it or not, there has been a revolution under Obama. It wasn't the revolution that everyone was anticipating, but there was a revolution. There was a revolution that placed in Nazi Germany. It wasn't a violent revolution when you saw what was taking place with the German people after World War II. Many people were in starvation. You had many people living out in the streets, homeless. Their cities were wrecked. They were, they were very destitute as a result of the end of the war. Hunger.
Right.
And then the revolution took place because here, you had the new regime came in and they start talking about how they were going to build up the country, how they were going to make, that they were the superior race and how they were going to build their streets and rebuild the infrastructure of that country. And the people bought into the lies of Hitler, and that was before a war took place. But, Alan, there was a revolution. Now, when we look at the revolution that took place in Russia, that was a revolution that was more, it was a violent revolution, but it brought about change and thrust the Communist Party into the rule of that nation. When you look at in France around the time of Napoleon, that was a revolution that took place. And even when you look at the history of this country, Alan, there was a revolution. It was a violent revolution. You had tens of thousands of people died as a result of that revolution with the British at that time. So revolution, it can be violent or nonviolent. We have seen this country, the U.S., take over other governments by creating a situation where revolution is imminent in those countries. When we see the Arab Spring and we see what we have done to have created that situation in those countries, and subsequently revolution is the end result. But Alan, when we talk about revolution and we talk about the change that America, here on the left, we say that we need a revolution in this country. What are we talking about? Are we talking about violence? Are we talking about major changes toward a socialist society or society that's for working people? What kind of revolution are we talking about?
Well, I think that the only revolution we can talk about is a socialist revolution. And whether it's going to be peaceful or violent, that largely depends on how much opposition there is and what kind of opposition there is from those in power, from the Wall Street crowd. And I think that what we've seen so far all throughout history in this country is, you know, we have a very violent ruling class. It's very savage and barbaric in its violence, in fact. And, you know, people will have to defend their rights. I think as the way I look at things right now, we have to challenge Wall Street for political and economic power. And if we look at Canada, I think that sets kind of an example of what we have to do here in this country. Right now, the New Democratic Party, it's the socialist New Democratic Party in Canada, is on the verge of taking national political power for the very first time. And they're taking political power away from Bay Street, which is like Wall Street here in this country, the financial center. And what they'll be doing is putting political power in the hands of working people. In the province of Manitoba, working people have had power for quite a few years through the New Democratic Party. But without economic power, it's hard for them to make, you know, really deep-seated changes. And so we've got to begin to talk about, you know, in a democracy, people have the right to make political decisions and economic decisions. And this is what I think we have to work for. We need, like here in Minnesota, we had the socialist Minnesota Farmer Labor Party that took over the governorship. It was the majority in the state house and almost achieved the majority in the state senate. And it had what was called the Farmer Labor Association, which was a massive anti-monopoly type coalition that was the backbone of the Minnesota Farmer Labor Party. And I would hope more leftists would look at the history of the Minnesota Farmer Labor Party to see, you know, what kind of coalition politics we really need to develop in this country, because I think this is part of the way that we have to go on the road to socialist revolution is what was done back in the 1930s here in Minnesota. And it can be achieved again. We see that the majority of the American people have stated they have no confidence in either political party, the Democrats or the Republicans, but we haven't really made a case yet for what kind of political party we need. And there's a real problem there, and that the right wing, you see it with the Tea Party and these other right wingers, they're moving in and they're playing on a lot of the problems of the people in the same way Obama did. And so, will these people build up their own political party before we on the left can offer an alternative to the American people and get the working people involved in building their own political party? I think that's a major task we've got to accomplish. I don't think there will be a socialist revolution without massive participation in a left-wing electoral coalition of some kind. It may be that we get to the point where people just say we're fed up and they take to the streets and put an end to, Wall Street's domination and an end to capitalism. That could happen because we got, close to 30% of the people in this country, the polls show, are very sympathetic, if not supportive, of socialism.
Right.
So people are thinking about socialism right now, but we haven't really brought socialist ideas to the American people yet. You know, we haven't presented socialist solutions to things like the healthcare problem, where, you know, as socialists we should be presenting, in my opinion, we should be presenting not just single payer, but we should be presenting a national public health care system
that's similar to public education. See what happens, Alan, is every 4 years, first of all, the Democrats and Republicans, they spend 4 years breaking their promises. And then they,
right.
At the end of that 4 years, they come in with a whole new set of promises that we're going to get it right this time, you know. And then people have a tendency where they believe that, okay, they even did it with Obama. Well, he didn't get it right for the first 3.5 years, but we need to give him another chance. And then they say, well, we gave him a chance after 2 terms, and he didn't make it. So now let's try Republican. They don't realize that they're voting for another Democrat with just a different name. But, you know, American people are just constantly going on promises. And the other thing, what I see, Alan, is it's all about appeasement. They just give people just enough to keep them quiet. In other words, it's $9 an hour. So what we're going to do is we're going to increase that poverty wage up to $9.50 an hour. And people say, well, at least we got something. Well, you're still living at home with mom and dad because you can't afford your own place. You can't afford any groceries. You can't afford transportation. Alan, but we see this in this, especially here in this country. It's all about appeasing the masses. So when you talk about a revolution, people say, well, it's really not that bad, you know. But they're living in poverty. They're homeless. They haven't had a job for a year and a half, but they still have another 26 weeks of, you know, 26 weeks where they can collect unemployment. So once 26 weeks are up, I'll deal with that then. But, Alan, we're still in the same rut while the people on Wall Street are raking in like never before.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, part of the problem, I think, Stuart, is that, again, socialists haven't done a very good job in bringing our solutions in front of the American, putting them in front of the American
good
people.
Good point.
On the issue of the minimum wage, the reason that socialists and communists were able to organize the industrial unions is because they always put in front of the working people, what are your wages compared to what you can buy? They always talked about wages in comparison to cost of living. And this isn't being done in this country right now. If you'll notice, the conversation centers on everything except wages and cost of living when we're talking about the minimum wage. All these politicians and all those so-called labor leaders, they will talk about everything under the sun other than wages in relation to cost of living. They'll talk about executive salaries as if, you know, we are living in a capitalist country, and it's only to be expected that these corporate executives are going to be making a lot more money than working people. But what isn't acceptable to the American people is that, you know, the American people believe that they're entitled to a living wage that where they can meet their cost of living. And, you know, so we got to keep pushing this idea. To a guy like Richard Trumka, like they're bringing him into Minnesota this week, to push for this $9.50 minimum wage. And for Richard Trumka, who's a millionaire, he's become a millionaire off of the dues of working people. To him, it doesn't mean anything what you pay for a car, what you pay for a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk or a pound of hamburger, because he can go out and he can buy the best of everything. And so the cost of living means nothing to him. It's not there's no urgency in his eyes. You know, he's not worried about if his kids are going to get milk with their meal or if they're going to get hot dogs instead of hamburger or if they're going to have to, you know, a lot of people around where I live on the Indian reservations, they actually have to mix water with their milk in order to make it last longer. So, you know, a guy like Richard Trumka has no concept of what people are going through, and especially people in poverty. And so we got to, as socialists, we got to keep throwing this out there. What is your cost of living compared to, you know, what this minimum wage is and what $9.50 or $10.10 can purchase? You know, and people will begin to, then they'll begin to understand we got to have a living wage. And when we talk about fighting for a living wage, we're fighting Wall Street. It's it's the Chamber of Commerce, it's all these Wall Street investors that are ganging up and saying, hey, you know, we're not going to put up with any living wages, and the American people are going to have to be convinced to fight back, because we got to present to the American people that, you know, it's working people that have created all this wealth, and we're at least entitled to enough of that wealth so that we can survive with a decent standard of living. And this is the class aspect. Now you have guys like George Lakoff, the number one hack for the Democratic Party. He says, you know, we can't talk about things like this. It's going to cause, you know, class war, and it's going to cause disturbances in the streets. We got to be careful not to talk like this. Well, as socialists, this is the way we have to be talking. They will caution us. Oh, you know, I have politicians tell me every day, oh, Alan, you know, cool it, you know, hold things down a little bit. The governor of Minnesota, Mark Dayton, accused me of winding the springs so tight, it's gonna they're going to bust and backfire on them, you know. And this is what they don't want to hear. We got to be speaking to the American people in terms of what's really going on in this country. Otherwise, people aren't going to listen to us, and we're not going to be effective. The way we can be effective is by telling the truth, and that's what we got to constantly keep exposing, is that, you know, we're spending, this government is wasting money on wars and militarism instead of spending money on meeting the needs of the people. We got to keep exposing that it's big business that doesn't believe that we're entitled to decent wages, and yet as a result of these poverty wages, big business and the Wall Street people are literally reaping huge super profits from the differential between what would be a living wage and what is a poverty wage. You know, they're reaping super profits at the expense of people, of working people living in misery, and we got to keep exposing this.
Well, you know, when I see some of the things that are taking place in other countries, and I believe revolution starts with revolutionary changes, because the thing is, you know, you can have violent revolution. You can have a revolution like what Obama was talking about, which is a revolution, actually it starts out with a lie, but you actually get change, but it's not the change that will benefit working people. Or we can start by with being given some honest programs and what will work for working people, and that's what where the Obama administration and what Obama, what he failed to do when he was talking to the American people 5 years ago. Now, I believe it's in Sweden that they have like a basic income of $2,800 per person. Is that Sweden that I'm thinking about, Alan?
I'm not sure what countries it actually have basic income.
I think it's Sweden. They came out with a basic income for everyone that lives, every adult in that country, where it's $2,800 per person. Basically, when you look at that in terms of an income, that's like $20 per person. If you look at the income that you need to earn to have that type of money, you make it somewhere between $20 to $22 an hour. Now, you have working full-time. And now you had Elizabeth Warren, which, you know, she, as a senator, she said if we had a real minimum wage in this country, she said the real number should be at $22 an hour. Alan, that's what we need to do is to push for those changes that will actually produce some real results for working people. Now, when we talk about minimum wage, Alan, we know it's pathetic, and I even see socialists saying that $10 an hour, that's a good move. $10 an hour, well, people on the left, I shouldn't just say socialists, $10 an hour is pathetic. But if we talk about around $22, $25 an hour, like Elizabeth Warren, like the many people like yourself, Alan, that's what now we're starting to talk about things that will actually take care of the cost of living for working people.
Right. And, you know, when we talk about a basic income guarantee, a lot of people have accused me of having, you know, these far-left ideas. They say, oh, you're so far out in left field, it's not even worth considering. But one of the greatest American revolutionaries, Tom Paine, he wrote about that we needed a basic income guarantee way back in 1797. And he explained that people were entitled to live decent lives you know, back then, and he was bringing that idea forward then. And then we had in 1945 the Full Employment Act.
The Roosevelt administration was talking about it. We had it talked about during the Richard Nixon administration. I mean, it has been that concept has been around for hundreds of years. It's nothing new.
No, it's the basic income guarantee. We should be fighting for that because even the minimum wage, and I explained this at a forum that was held here in Minneapolis this past Saturday, I explained that, you know, when we talk about the minimum wage, even if people are paid the minimum wage, we can't look at it as something based on a 40-hour work week because, you know, the Wall Street people, they're telling us right now, all these political pundits and everything are telling us the new normal is part-time employment. So even if somebody is getting $22 an hour, but they only work 12 to 14 hours a week, that is still not a living income. So we have a situation where we have to be talking about a living wage. That's one aspect of the problem. The other aspect is we have to be talking about a real living income. And on top of that, we have to be talking about full employment. You know, full employment means that people have decent jobs, decent paying jobs, real living wage jobs, working 40 hours a week. And, you know, it's a complete package. And this is where socialists can play an important role in this whole struggle over the minimum wage. And by injecting the need for a basic income guarantee and the need for full employment. The Democrats like to pose all these things as individual things and they like to tell us that, no, you got to do things gradually. We need these gradual reforms and incremental reforms. Well, like one woman pointed out Saturday, she said the landlord won't wait for his rent. You know, how can we wait for gradual reforms and incremental reforms to take place somewhere down the road where we don't even know if they'll ever take place after all? The minimum wage was first enacted in 1938 in this country, and Frances Perkins, who brought that minimum wage legislation forward, she said it was that she expected the minimum wage to rapidly become a real living wage. Now, that was 75 years ago. You know, how long do these people expect us to wait? How long do they expect people to be mired in this poverty that creates such misery? You know, these people that talk about gradual and incremental reforms, they got no concept of what working people are going through today. No concept whatsoever, because you know they're getting all these bribes from Wall Street and everything, and they're involved in all these swindles and scandals where they're raking in the dough, and all that they're raking in comes from the wealth that has been produced by working people that they don't want working people to have for themselves. You know,
right.
And this is where we're at, and we got to explain all this to the American people through letters to the editor, by forcing these people into public debates, and this is the way we'll begin to change things. I don't think we need to worry about whether a revolution will be peaceful or violent or anything like that. What we got to do is we got to state what kind of country we want to live in, and we got what kind of country we want that will be decent. And just,
and that's what we're going to talk about next.
Okay.
And once again, I just want to announce that we have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program. Once again, Alan Mackey is a political analyst and also a social activist. He's been involved in the arena protecting the rights of workers for well over half of it, the majority of his life. And we really appreciate the dedication and the service that he has made to society and working people. Alan, once again, I want to thank you for joining the program.
Well,
Alan, in the last few minutes of our show, we're going to talk about what should we expect as far as for a revolution. What type of revolution do we need for working people? Because if I talk, you know, to talk about what the changes that we need, I mean, Alan, they cover such a broad area. I mean, it covers for seniors, it covers for the disabled, it covers for veterans, it covers for you know, working people. It covers the Constitution. Now, we have lost all of our constitutional rights. But let's start right there with our Constitution. Alan, right now, Alan, it's only a piece of paper. Alan is a piece of paper. It's not worth anything. Alan, how do we get back to basics? I mean, here we have people went and fought for the rights for us to be free as a nation, for the people that lived here in this country to be free and have fair representation. Now we have a constitution which we believe that we have guaranteed rights, and it's nothing more than a piece of paper. Is that a good place to start with a revolution where we can restore the constitution for working people? Is that a good place to start?
I think it's a very good place to start. People often ask me, as a socialist, what do you want? What do you want to see in a socialist society? And I tell them, read the Constitution of the United States, read the Bill of Rights, and read the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And in those three documents, you have what socialists and communists and people that want real change, what they are seeking. And I think
right.
that, you know, it's through these documents that we're going to develop and implement and fight for programs in line with what our Constitution is all about, what our Bill of Rights is all about, and what the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights is all about. And, those documents, if those were made into real living reality, we'd have a pretty decent country. I think everybody would agree with that. You know, at least the majority of the people would agree with that. And so that's what I think we got to hold up is what we want. People all over the world have admired the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights for, years and years. And the problem is a lot of people don't realize that right here in the United States, we don't have those rights. It's a boast that these politicians make to the world. It's a hollow boast. It's a very hypocritical boast that this is the most democratic country in the world. And they hold up the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights on the one hand, and with the other hand, they got a billy club ready to beat people over the head and knock them down when they speak out, for what they need.
Right.
And
in my opinion, having the Bill of Rights being enforced in this country, our rights as citizens, that would be revolutionary in itself. But
exactly.
Alan, when it comes to revolutionary changes, things that would benefit working people, when we talk about something as far as protecting, the rights of women, the rights of gays and lesbians in this country, that protect the rights of many of the people that are disabled. Alan, we see today none of that is being really enforced on a level where we have a balance and everyone has that equal right to justice in this country. We have been let down by this government in Washington,
yes.
And we have seen it decade after decade. But this is something that the socialists that we're calling for, we believe that women deserve the rights. They need to make the same wages. They need to have the same wages for the time that they spend in the workplace, the same opportunities as any male, gays and lesbians and transsexuals. They need to have the same rights in the workplace, in our communities, and it's not happening with the Democrats and Republicans.
No. In fact, since Obama has been in power, there's been a lot of talk about the National Labor Relations Board and everything that he's improved and crap like that. But if you talk to any working people at any workplace, they will tell you the level of harassment is at such a high level they can't hardly stand to work anymore. And, people have no rights in the workplace in this country right now. They say, if you don't like working here, quit. We'll find somebody
right.
else that's unemployed that'll take your job.
Explain to people what right to work states. Explain to our listeners what that really means.
Well, it means the right to work for less and the right to work without any rights being enforced. But it goes further than that, Stuart. Even where there are unions and where right to work, it doesn't exist yet. And I'm not sure if it's most of the states. A lot of the states have right to work legislation right now. But even in the states where that doesn't exist, workers have very little rights in this country right now. And it's almost impossible, even where you have unions in a workplace, the unions are so weak that they're incapable of fighting for even the things that are written into the contract. Try and file a grievance. for a worker just to file a grievance, it's a major, major problem. I was just with somebody talking to an attorney today, and somebody that had was suspended for 10 days for being a little late for work. This is absurd. Who ever heard of such a thing? You know, but
right.
This is the kinds of things that working people are being subjected to. And the union, there's a union in this workplace, and the union will not file grievances. They will not go to arbitration. They tell workers, oh, it'll be too expensive for us to take this to arbitration when the grievance fails. You know, what the heck is a union for if not to do these things, to fight in the workplace for the rights of working people? And yet working people have very, very little rights. You can ask any worker that has problems at work what the solution to their problems is, and they'll tell you, we don't know. We can't get help from our union. And if we complain, we're just subjected to the worst kinds of harassment and intimidation in the workplace. We're
Alan, if you don't have a union, you can't even get any protection from the state anymore.
No, none at all.
If you call the state, the only thing you do is just get a line, where you can get some information over the phone, and they don't even have where you can even walk into an office and even fill out a grievance anymore.
Yeah, I had a situation just a few months ago where a complaint was made to the U.S. Department of Labor trying to get them to enforce wages and hours, where an employer was trying to get people to work for 15 minutes before they punched in, and then to work a little longer after they punched out. And the U.S. Department of Labor says, oh, you know, you're only talking about 20 minutes or half an hour. We can't spend thousands of dollars on a complaint like that. But what the heck is the Wages and Hours Act legislation even for them if they're not going to work to enforce this, you know? What difference does it make? They should be taking on these cases of each and every worker where there's a complaint and where these, this is wage theft. It's been properly called as wage theft, where workers are being forced, if they come in to work maybe 15 minutes before they punch in, an employer will give them a broom and tell them, oh, just go over there and sweep the floor for a little while. And then after they punch out, they say, oh, we got a little something over here. Just help us out over here for another 15 or 20 minutes. This people not being paid for this, this is wage theft. So, you know,
What is your opinion about affirmative action? Because I think that would bring about some type of revolutionary change in this country as well. What is your opinion about affirmative action?
Affirmative action has to be enforced. There's no way that people of color and women and the handicapped are going to have any rights at all as far as when it comes to employment in the first place or rights on the job unless affirmative action is being enforced. Affirmative action has not been enforced since Obama has been in office. And almost $1 trillion of taxpayers' money was spent on these bailing out Wall Street and everything and so-called public works jobs. And affirmative action wasn't enforced any dates where any of this money was spent. This is actually a crime. I don't say that to exaggerate or anything, but affirmative action is the law of the land. And for these politicians not to enforce affirmative action, they are breaking the law. It's just like George Wallace standing in the doorway preventing somebody from going to school because of the color of their skin. Well, now affirmative action isn't being enforced, and people who are entitled to jobs are not receiving those jobs, and it's based on the color of their skin or because they're a woman or because they're handicapped. And these politicians are violating the law. The corporations doing this, the contractors and the construction companies, they're violating the law. Nobody's being prosecuted. There hasn't been one single prosecution.
And myself, I work in a company where we have around 125 employees. I'm the only black that works here. And if a woman applies for a job in the service department, good luck, because it's not going to happen. You know, not unless she's applying for a job to answer the phones, but as far as going to the shops, in other words, that application, you know, just might as well put it right in the shredder. It's not going to happen. And, Alan, this is not just the company I work for. This is happening across the country.
Yeah, all across the country, from private industry and private employment to the public sector. It's going on all over. And that's why for the first time since Lyndon Johnson signed affirmative action into law, Executive Order 11246, for the first time now in about the last 7 to 8 years, The situation has gotten worse for people of color, women, and the handicapped because affirmative action is no longer being enforced. And like I say, it's a crime, and these politicians are getting away with it. Here in Minnesota, we've got $2 billion projects, a big bridge over the St. Croix River for $1 billion plus, and the biking stadium, $1 billion, almost $1 billion of taxpayers' money is being pumped into that, and affirmative action is not being enforced. I actually met with Governor Dayton while he was running for office, and he agreed to enforce affirmative action. Once elected, now he's talking about voluntary quotas. You know, voluntary quotas have never worked. You need strict enforcement of affirmative action if the if racism in employment is going to be remedied. You know, we've seen that this is you know, the history of this country. We only saw improvements made once Lyndon Johnson signed that into the law, and these politicians were serious about enforcing affirmative action. Even Richard Nixon said when it comes to public expenditures and spending the public's money, everybody is entitled to the jobs that are created when that money is spent. And Nixon, you know, said that he was for enforcing affirmative action, and he enforced affirmative action. Ever since Ronald Reagan was in power, affirmative action hasn't been enforced. And the things have been going downhill ever since.
We have three more minutes, and I just want you to touch on a couple of things. Is it possible to create jobs for everyone in this country? Is that a possibility?
It's very easy. We could put everybody in this country to work doing socially useful things. You know, we need a WPA program. We need a CCC program. We need a CETA program. We need a universal health care system, a national public health care system that would put 12 to 15 million people to work. A national public child care system would put another 3 to 5 million people to work. There's no reason for one single person to be unemployed in this country. Just stop these wars and stop the militarism and put people to work instead, doing things that are socially useful and necessary. Very simple.
What is the next step as far as if we're to move in the direction of creating revolutionary changes? Obviously, the majority of the people in this country, they don't want a violent revolution. I don't think anyone wants a violent revolution. Even the people that we have brought that to their countries over in the Middle East. But what is the next step? Is it by socialists being out front and outspoken and spreading what socialism has to offer? What is the next step where we can have revolutionary changes in this country for working people?
Well, I think that socialists are going to have to speak their mind as socialists, not as just liberals or progressives. But socialists and communists have always been the catalyst to real change. And so that means that it's up to socialists. Nobody else is going to do it. It's too bad, but nobody else is going to do it except for socialists. We have to bring the solutions to the problems into the public square for the American people to consider. Things like, you know, we've been talking about a national public health care system. I think we also have to learn to, you know, strike when the iron is hot. And that means that right now there's a massive conversation all across this country about the minimum wage. And this gives socialists a perfect opportunity to step into this debate and bring forward
the
our ideas. That
the iron is hot. You're right. Alan, how can people reach you?
They can call me at, right now I'm on the road, so they can reach me on my cell phone, 651-587-5541, or they can Google my name, Alan Mackey, A-L-A-N-M-A-K-I, and they'll come across my blog, the Podunk blog, and all my contact information, email, and everything is there.
I want to tell you, Alan, we really appreciate it. You're reaching hundreds of thousands of people every week through this broadcast. I can tell by the results, people are contacting us and say they really look forward to hearing you. They want links to the program. That's very encouraging to me. And I just want to tell you and Ruth Ann, thanks for making a difference. We look forward to having our listeners to join us once again next week on the Socialist Insight. Alan, thanks again. Ruth Ann, thanks again. We look forward to having our listeners to join us then. Have a good night.
Well, thanks. Thanks for
good
having
night.
Me. Good
night. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening. listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
What's up, everybody? This is Dialectics Radio Show. I'm your host, Nikolai Brown. We got a really special show this week. I'm really excited about it. We have a representative from Men Prisons with us. We're just not going to waste any time this week. We're going to get right into it. How's it going?
Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Actually, my name is Wyatt. I'm not your representative from the prison. How are you?
I said representative from Men Prisons.
Oh, yes. I'm actually doing quite well. I mean, I was kind of inspired to call, you know, hearing the last segment about socialism and affirmative action and things like that. And I suppose that discussion might be over at this point.
I think it is.
Okay. Well, what topic are you discussing? Because that was the one that had piqued my interest.
Is 661 where your guest is coming from?
It's a California number.
This is a comment from
in Connecticut. I've had a lot of experience in prisons, though, because I've had a chance to visit hundreds of them, literally, as part of my career.
Hey, Nick, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Yes.
Well, hey, Ruthann, maybe grab his info and see if you can call back towards the end of the show.
I have it, yes. Wyatt, right.
Yes.
So I'm sorry, it was my mistake, because I thought that when he called in that he was your guest, and he isn't.
No,
so
I am.
One is, okay.
My apologies.
I'm sorry.
All right, are we ready to go?
I think we are. Sorry about that, everybody. So now we have on a representative from Men Prisons. Pretty excited to have him on. I'll let them explain more about it. But so how are you doing today, first of all? Sorry about the mix-up right there.
I'm doing well, Nick. It's good to be on the show, and revolutionary greetings to all your listeners today.
Well, thank you for joining us. Like I said, it's definitely exciting for me. Read your stuff a lot and find it pretty inspiring. So let's get right into it, though. You're from the Maoist Internationalist Ministry of Prisons. That's a pretty big mouthful. So let's just start it from the beginning. A lot of people might not know exactly what Maoism is, or might have misconceptions about that. So what is your organization's perspective, why Maoism, how would you relate that to people?
Right. So we call ourselves Men Prisons for short, and the quick definition of who we are is we think we're a cell revolutionary serving the oppressed masses inside U.S. prisons, and we're guided by the communist ideology of Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, as you just stated. I would like to get into that a little bit. You know, your show, the name Dialectics, I think it's has a dual meaning. But when we think of dialectics, we think of dialectical materialism, which of course was the philosophy developed by Marx and Engels. And it's integral, to everything that we do. It's how we analyze the world around us. So it's something that it's worth stressing. I think when I read a lot of other people's stuff, I don't necessarily, and maybe you can see whether I'm biased here, but I feel like when I read our stuff, that you can see that we're applying dialectical materialism in our analysis, and I don't always get that from a lot of organizations that even claim to be Marxist, Maoist, or whatever. And the importance for this is having a framework within which you can define what you're going to do and what you expect the outcome to be of those actions. And I think if you take a step back and see even broader than outside of Marxist groups, a lot of groups don't even have that framework. And what you then succumb to is subjectivism or populism. So just kind of you do what feels good to you, you do what is popular. And if you share in our analysis of the society in the United States where most people have an economic interest in imperialism, doing what's popular is not usually the right thing. So having a framework to which to organize your thought is important for this reason. And we, you know, Mim always talked about having a scientific method. And I give Mim a lot of credit because for those of us who came up studying Mim, I think they really did a good job teaching people how to think scientifically. And we try to do that as well. Hopefully we do a good job of that. But I think it's something that's it's easy for people to see if you think about things like technology, right? You look at, you know our computers and all this technology that we have, and it's really obvious that things keep improving and we keep building on the technology of the past, right? But what isn't often seen is how this is applied to other things like society, sociology, history, philosophy. And this is part of the bourgeois world outlook that focuses on individuals, focuses on great person theory of history. It leads people to looking at history as a, you know, there's this idea that history is cyclical because of human nature. Things like greed and lust for power are what drive history. But what Marx did is he looked at history and he said, no, there's actually an evolution of history. And what he tried to do is to build up a science of society. You know, we might call it sociology. And, you know, certainly we have sociology as a science in our society, but it's not really looked at the same way as things like technology, where we're constantly building on the knowledge of the past. And so that's something that Marxists try to do and try to promote, this idea that, you know, we have all this experience and most of it is history. 99% of our knowledge is based in history. But then we have to take the scientific approach to building on that. And it's the same scientific method that you may have learned in grade school. You look at a problem, you look at a phenomenon, you do some initial research or observations, develop a hypothesis to explain that problem or phenomenon. Then you develop an experiment or you initiate some kind of practice. You reflect back on the outcomes of that practice, and then you refine your hypothesis. And over time, if you keep confirming the hypothesis, it becomes a theory. And I think sometimes in our culture, the word theory is misused as if a theory, you know, like people say global climate change is just a theory, implying that it's not real. But a theory is something that's been tested throughout, you know, been rigorously tested and something that provides an integral part of a scientific framework. So when we talk about Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, we're looking at three stages of history where revolutionary theory had been developed, and that's because of practice. You know, the times of Marx and Engels, the times of Lenin and Stalin, and the times of Mao and the Chinese Communist Party, these were times of great practice and experimentation where new theories could be tested and confirmed. And so that's why we call it what it is, Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, and we try to apply that science in our day-to-day work.
So that was pretty abstract, kind of focusing on a lot of like methodology, but what are some of the I guess maybe more so like the principles of Maoism or dialectic?
Right.
I don't know if you know, this is a pretty big audience. You know, not everybody is necessarily familiar with even these terms themselves.
Right, yeah. So a quick definition, dialectical materialism, it's two things. Marx and Engels put it together, but materialism is this idea that there's a world outside of our our heads, outside of our imaginations, that we can interact with and study and understand and even change. To quote Huey P. Newton, founder of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, he said, you know, he tried to define power. He defined it as the ability to define a phenomenon and make it act in the desired manner. I think that's a good definition of what materialism is. We're trying to define phenomenons and make them act in a desired manner. Now, the dialectical piece of dialectical materialism is something that Marx took from Hegel, and it can be kind of complex if you get into it, but I think a simple definition is that things are always in a constant state of flux, constantly changing, and there's always two primary forces within a thing that define that change. It's the struggle between those two forces that define a change. And this isn't like a – it's not like a mystical thing like, oh, God made – the world so that everything is made up of two things. It's just a framework for how we can understand things and look at it in a systematic way so that we can prioritize what factors are important in understanding something.
Definitely.
Okay. To get more concrete, I can list some examples of what are some things that are make up our framework. This is kind of the framework of MIM thought in general. It's just, these aren't unique to our organization, but when we look at dialectics, you know, you're talking about contradictions between things. That's the word that Mao used all the time in his famous essay on contradiction. And you want to find the principal contradiction in a thing. So, for example, we look at the world today, the imperialist world, the principal contradiction being that between the oppressed nations and the oppressor nations. Similarly, within the United States, we look at the principal contradiction being the American nation versus the internal semi-colonies. It's a very similar contradiction, but substance. The principal contradiction that we see within America, the nation, we talk about nations, we're not talking about countries, but the American nation is, we see it as youth versus adults, which we put in the realm of gender, which is another topic, but it gets at something that we see as important is that there are three, we see there's three strands of oppression in our society, class, gender, and nation. And that shapes a lot about how we approach things, you know, because we don't, you know, we wouldn't say, for example, that humans versus animals or humans versus the environment are a strand of oppression in our society. And so that has a big effect on what life. One last example is, our class analysis, which I mentioned earlier. That's something that Mim was famous for. Seeing that, you know, most of the people in the United States or in previous countries in general, exploiters and allied with imperialism, it gives us a unique, unique examples of nation and gender, where class is not dominating that situation. And so we can see a lot of things in this country that I think Mim really enlightened us on in regards to gender and nation.
All right. We'll get a little bit more concrete. That's a little bit about the politics. The other part of your name is the Maoist Internationalist Ministry of Prisons. So what sort of work do you do inside of prisons?
We do our mission. Well, so the primary, we kind of follow Mim's on what the principal task is, mission of the oppressed to seize power.
You were breaking up just a little bit there. Can you repeat that?
Our principal task we see, and following in the footsteps of Mim, we see our principal task as building public opinion and independent institutions in order to seize power and overthrow imperialism. Within the prison context, that's kind of the twofold approach. We do a lot of...
Let me ask you this. Why prisons? That's a very broad sort of task in and of itself, building public opinion and independent institutions to seize power. And obviously there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of sorts of work that could be done around this. What sort of analysis leads you to focus on prisoners, lump-in elements, you know, people who are held captive in the United States?
Sure. So we think there's a number of good things people can be doing, and we chose to focus on prisons with the idea that there are other things that would be just as valuable. So we don't think that it's necessarily the most important thing, but we do see prison work as a priority for our movement because it's really, when you get on into the front lines of, well, okay, let me step back. What I said earlier, the principal contradiction in this country we see as a nation. So right there, because of that analysis, we're saying that that's the most important thing, is to push this contradiction between the internal semi-colonies and the oppressor American nation, and that liberating the internal semi-colonies is what's going to do the most here in the U.S., in North America, to imperialism, put an end to oppression, create a better world. So prisons are kind of at the front line of that. The whole injustice system really is at the front line. It's where the oppressed nations are being brutalized, you know, it's how, you know, people are killed in the street by the cops or tortured for years in prisons. These are some of the most blatant examples of national oppression. And so for that reason, it's just kind of natural for us to gravitate towards doing prison work.
Definitely. And you mentioned kind of torture. There's a lot of, I mean, a lot of people don't realize this, but the conditions in U.S. prisons are, you know, by U.N. definitions, they are torture. I mean, this isn't hyperbole to state that locking somebody in an 8x10 cell for 30 years is a form of torture. That's, you know, very much considered within the realm of torture by international standards. And you guys do a lot of campaigns around shoes and special housing units. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture said 15 days was a reasonable limit for long-term isolation. So there's we've done surveys. 15 days, yeah.
And people are locked in there for, what, 15 years, you know, 20, 30 years sometimes?
A lot, yeah. There's a lot of people that have been in that long. And a lot of that's connected to, you know, the national liberation movements of the past. There's direct connections to people who have spent that many years in long-term isolation. Indicating the clear political motivations of this. But
I see.
Yeah,
so what are some of the campaigns you do around special housing units?
Well, you know, our overall campaign is to shut them down because they're torture. The security housing units is what they're called in California. We often use control units as a general term, but whatever you want to call them, we define them as long-term isolation, where you're in your cell 23 or more hours a day with very limited to no access to any kind of programs or outside contacts. By our research, we've estimated around 100,000 people in this country are in these torture cells. So that's a lot.
Yeah.
And these are all people who have been in more than 15 days.
Wow.
Yeah, the conditions are horrendous, and it's I'll talk about California a bit just because some of your listeners may be familiar. It's been in the news the last few years because there's been a series of hunger strikes. It started in July 2011. It was the first one. And then the third one was this past July in 2013. There's a series of three hunger strikes. Each one, the participants more than doubled each time. So it went from, you know, somewhere like 6,800 to over 13,000 to around 33,000 this past year, which is impressive. That's, you know, about a quarter of the California prison population. And people who are familiar with California prisons know that there's a history of divisions along what are called racial or organizational lines, different lumpen organizations, which usually divide along nationalities, which is generally encouraged by the prison system, have created rifts in the past in the California prison system. So to see this kind of unity is monumental and important. And it speaks to, you know, the power of lumpen organizations. And when we look at, you know, we look at the people in prison as being a subset of what we call the lumpen class or the first world lumpen, distinguishing them from the lumpen proletariat in the third world, who are people who are excluded from the, you know, basically excluded from the economy. They don't really work legal jobs, or at least not very often. And as a result, a lot of them end up in prison doing the things that they end up doing.
So definitely a very oppressed class. And to back up just a little bit, you know, this isn't the – prisons don't have to be like this. You know, this isn't the only way to kind of – I mean, granted, kind of, you know, prisons are necessarily an instrument of class rule. But, you know, substance of a prison, the content, how it's ran, doesn't have to be like they are in the United States today. And, you know, calling yourselves the Maoist Internationalist Ministry of Prisons, I was wondering if you would want to speak to a little bit about what prisons were like in revolutionary China and maybe
sure.
how it differs from prisons here.
Sure. I would love to do that. It's very, very relevant topic right now. I'll start with China just to give a quick overview. There's a couple of good books out there, one by Alan and Adele Rickett called Prisoners of Liberation, and then there's an autobiography of Pu Yi, which sections of it are about his time in prison. He was the last emperor of Manchuria, so he was definitely of the oppressor class, and he came out of it, as well as Alan and Adele Rickett, who were American students accused of spying on the Chinese socialism. They all came out of it very favorable with a favorable reflection of the experience that they had there, and that experience being put in group situations. You know, they had to live together with other prisoners, and the conditions might not be as good as prisoners in the U.S. today, but conditions were comparable or better than what people in China at the time had. Like the prisoners never went hungry, whereas in China, in those days, there was periods when people went hungry. So you can't really compare the actual conditions to those of prisoners in the U.S., but the key difference is that these people were put in cells in small groups where they had to organize themselves to kind of, you know, just live together, make food, clean their cells, and then they were required to study. And part of it was reflecting on what they did and writing essays on what they did and why it was wrong, which they would give to the prison staff, and they would, you know, have dialogue with them about, you know, why what they did was wrong, and trying to repent and reform was the basic concept. Now, in the United States, talk about California in particular, we have the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation is the name. They recently, something has been a recent news hot topic is we've gotten some reports from comrades in security housing units who have got access to documents that were examples of these journals that are part of this new step-down program. It's a program where they try to get people to leave their lumpen organizations, give up their alleged criminal lives, and the idea is that they've reformed and they can then rejoin the general population in prison rather than being locked in these torture cells. And some prisoners got a hold of these journals, they're obviously intentionally leaked to them, whatever the motivations of the prison staff was. They got a hold of them. And, you know, so there's been a few articles out there. We recently posted one from a comrade about what they're all basically condemning these as brainwashing tactics that are being enforced on people in prison. Now, one thing that we would be a little hesitant to condemn them for asking people to, you know, evaluate the things that they did, because we think that is part of the role of going to prison, is to reflect on what you did, why it was wrong, and to change your ways. That should be the part of a prison system that would serve the people, like the one in China did. Now, the problem is you have a state, an imperialist state, who's responsible for more murders and deaths around the world than any other state in the history of mankind, and they're telling these guys that they need to repent for these petty crimes. And so you can understand how they feel a bit upset and are unwilling to along with this program. Now, the other main difference, though, as you recall, I was talking about the conditions in the Chinese prison, how they were encouraged to work together and study together. And you can also recall I talked about the conditions in the California SHU, these people who are being asked to or who are being told that to get out of these torture cells, you have to participate in this, quote, step-down program. They're being thrown in isolation cells by themselves with little to no human interaction usually for years, sometimes for decades. And they're being denied at every turn access to basic things like books and radios and any kind of access to the outside world. And then they're being given these journals and told to reform their ways. So there's a class character that distinguishes these two systems, where the class character of the U.S. prisons have a bourgeois character that leads the system to use torture to try to get people to reform, whereas the proletarian character of the socialist prisons in China used group participation, group study as a means of reforming.
Yeah, and if anybody has a chance, that book is really good. It's called Prisoners of Liberation by Alan and Adele Ricketts. And I'm looking at your website now, prisoncensorship.info, and the article, for people who are curious, is called Leaked Document on CDCR Step-Down Program Exposes Brainwash Techniques. And, that's kind of interesting that they kind of, you know, take this kind of progressive step one way, you know, the prison system would, and then it turns around and it's just more like a pivot to you know, cause more discord between prisoners, it seems like. But, you know, I don't want to speculate too much on their...
And it's a facade. It's a facade because, as I said, there's been three hunger strikes, each one bigger than the last, over the last 3 years, with a lot of public support on the outside, attention internationally. So, you know, for them, they're trying to say, hey, look, you know, we changed the SHU system. So people can get out of the SHU now. So, you know, we made things better. But nothing's changed. The same.
Now, I was kind of curious. At one point, your publications were banned throughout a number of California prisons. Is that still the case?
No, it's not. Thankfully,
we're good to hear.
Some good lawyers affiliated with Prison Legal News did a lawsuit, and that is no longer the case. So we are getting into California prisons pretty regularly. Censorship is always a problem in almost every state in a hit or miss kind of basis, but there are a couple of states. North Carolina, I can give a shout out to North Carolina. They've banned every issue of UOK for over 3 years straight now.
Wow. So now what are some of the worst states in terms of banning your materials, and what can people do I don't really like to tell people, oh, call your senator or something like that, but if there is some people can do to you know, perhaps get some reprieve whenever it comes to the censorship that you guys are facing, what's the best thing that people can do, and where are the states that are especially bad whenever it comes to censorship?
Sure, yeah. Like I said, most states have some censorship. States like California are so big that we're always dealing with a little bit of censorship. But some of the really bad ones, I mentioned North Carolina. We've been ongoing struggle in Illinois, which has been, we've had some victories, but then some setbacks. New Mexico, Arizona, we've had a lot of problems, and I think we've really lost some of our contacts. There's sort of interesting thing in North Carolina is that we just keep getting more subscribers. We've been banned for 3 years, and people are still interested in our stuff. So their plan isn't working. But as far as supporting us, you know, yeah, you can really do a lot on various levels. You know, one of the things that we spend a lot of time doing, and you know, if people could help us out, then we would have time to do other things, is just writing letters to these prison crats and appealing these decisions, which, you know, oftentimes get responses and get things overturned, because there is an appeals process that's kind of required by law. And, you know, sometimes it's the guards that are being dicks about it, and, you know, someone above them will, you know, give us the okay. So writing these letters is something that we have a real easy way to plug people in. If people want to volunteer and do that, they can. And then, of course, lawyers. You know, if there's lawyers, people with legal resources out there, you know, we can hook you up with prisoners. We keep tons of documentation. Most of it's on our website if you want to browse it. But we have all the original documents, so we're ready. We're ready to do a lawsuit as soon as someone wants to take it up.
All right. Well, hopefully there's a lawyer out there listening, and he's on the side of justice and whatnot. And I just want to throw it out there one more time. Your website is prisoncensorship.info. And, you know, if there's somebody out there who's listening right now who maybe has a friend or a loved one who's in prison, and if they want to somehow get them in contact with you, is that possible in any sort of way? Or can you give out your contact info so you know, people might be able to forward that around and perhaps get you more contacts in prisons?
Yeah. You know, we have a mailing address. It's P.O. Box 40799, San Francisco, California, 94140. That's where prisoners can write us. But if you want to get a prisoner on our list, all you got to do is send their info to us. You can check out our website. We have an online form, and our email contact is on there.
Okay. Go ahead and give that P.O. Box number one more time.
Sure. The P.O. Box 40799, San Francisco, California, zip code 94140.
Cool. Now, and you guys have your own particular analysis of the prison system and the role that it plays within society. And I know a lot of people talk a lot about, you know, the prison industrial complex. And I have seen before that's kind of a term that you've challenged. But what in your opinion or your organization's policy, I suppose, what do you see the role of prisons in American society?
We see the role of prisons as a means of social control, and this is something we stress over and over again, especially the people who like to throw around the term prison industrial complex, because it tends to imply or outrightly say that prisons are about profit, which is something we have disagreed with since our beginning. We've put a series of articles out on the economy of the U.S. prison system, dispelling this myth that it's all about profit. And it's something that we look at. It's kind of it's fundamental to our differences with much of the white nationalist left, the social democrats, who want to blame everything on corporations. The prison industrial complex, that term implies that it's the fault of the greed of the corporations that created this prison system. And as I think you talked about in one of your previous shows, you brought up the question of first importance, who are our friends and who are our enemies. So oftentimes people who use that term, prison industrial complex, will see things, and this is true for many people in this country, see things as our enemies are the corporations, our friends are everybody else. Well, that's not our analysis. In fact, our analysis is that most people in the U.S., especially white Americans, supported and really created the U.S. prison system. And it was about national oppression from the very beginning. It was a response to the national liberation movements of the late 60s, early 70s. The fear of what many white people had of those movements and what would happen if the oppressed nations actually liberated themselves is what led to the crackdown and the prison boom that peaked in the mid-90s. And it was the politics of it. It was people. It wasn't necessarily a cabal that was formulated by the people who run the system. Even it was something that came up organically in a lot of cases where politicians had to be tough on crime in order to get elected, and that was coming from the populace. They were saying, "Be tough on crime. You had to be tough on crime. If you weren't tough, if you showed one little weakness in regards to being tough on crime, you would lose the vote." And so that's why, you know, the thing to do was to get more money to the pigs, build more prisons, and that's still true today.
Definitely. It's what's that old saying I'm used to throw it around, that, you know, you can't be too reactionary in the United States to get elected to office, and that seems to be the case when it comes to law and order and things like that. Yeah. You know, Americans are very quick to support increased policing and things of that nature. I don't like to pathologize people, but I mean, Americans are a very fearful group of people, and in some respects, they have every reason to be. I mean, here's a nation which has set itself against the world, essentially. You know, so I mean, in some respect, they probably should be fearful, but on the other hand, you know, it just kind of heightens their sort of reaction to things in terms of supporting police, supporting, prisons, militarization and things of this nature.
They could get on the right side of history if they want.
They could. I mean, and that's not to say, you know, all white people are bad. There's plenty of, you know, excellent white allies out there, you know, today and throughout history, you know, starting with John Brown, you know, David Gilbert, you know, all sorts of folks. And, of course, David Gilbert, I mentioned him because he's actually doing a life sentence right now. Now, you guys fight a lot of legal battles, too, whenever it comes to helping prisoners file grievances against things that are going on in prisons. What's that like, or what's that about?
Yeah, so what we have, there's an organization. It's called United Struggle From Within, and it really predates our organization. It's an organization of prisoners who are anti-imperialist. And it was initiated and formed by our predecessors in the Maoist internationalist movement. And when we formed, we took over, you know, kind of trying to lead that organization. So many of the comrades that we work with, you know, have been doing this longer than we've been doing this, at least as an organization. And so United Struggle From Within is an organization for prisoners and former prisoners as well. And they focus on campaigns like the ones you mentioned, on the grievance campaign, which is an example of one that's really taken off. It kind of gets at the heart of due process, basic kind of democratic rights for prisoners, where, you know, prisoners are facing these abuses that supposedly they shouldn't be facing. You know, these are things that are, you know, shouldn't be happening according to the state, yet they are happening. And when they file a grievance, the grievance is being ignored. It's being thrown in the trash. It's, you know, whatever is happening, the grievances, the issues that they're grieving are not being addressed. And this is pretty common, to the point that it's been taken on. It started in California, some comrades in California, and it spread pretty quickly. Some comrades in California, at least one comrade took it to court, and people have, you know, made a pretty big campaign about it in California. But a number of other states, I think almost at least 10 other states or so, have taken up this campaign where, you know, they have petitions that each the USW in each state writes up a petition that's particular to their laws, and they pass them around, get signatures, and try to organize people. And, you know, it's one way to do outreach as well, for, you know, kind of reaching to the prison masses who aren't necessarily politicized or organized with just kind of basic issues that concern them. So it's an organizing tool for USW, and it's a way for them to hopefully push the prison administrators a little bit to get some more breathing room around some of these issues that concern them.
Cool. And I hope you don't mind me asking this. I've heard from you guys that you're working on some publications right now. Do you want to, you know, go into a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, one publication that I can speak about, because I know it will be out soon, it's a book titled Chicano Power and the Struggle for Islam. And it's primarily authored by a couple comrades in United Struggle from Within. But we're doing the editing and working with a publisher. We're in the later phases of editing that book right now, but it's you know, trying to address just the basics. It's trying to be a book for Chicanos to just outline what is, address these basic questions of land and nation and self-determination and in relation to Aslan, and to put it in a contemporary context, which leads to us giving a little focus to the prison struggle. In states like California, basically all the states in Aslan, most of them, to my knowledge, the majority of the people in control units are Chicanos. I know in California it's the vast majority. So again, this is this question of who's in prison, who's in these torture cells, is a question of national oppression. And so this book is about national liberation. It's in the work. It should be out. I'm going to say this summer it'll be out. Other stuff. Well, you know, if you're interested in this topic of control units, I would recommend the DVD that we have linked to from our website called Unlock the Box. It's a few years old, but it's really good material. It's, you know, good agitational material. It's good educational material on the control units, and that DVD is available through Kirp's Blubbadeb, which has a lot of other good stuff available, so you can check that out there. And that DVD also has a sample of an Alan Rickett interview that Nim did back in the day. And we actually have the full interview is on our website, and it's a popular file if you want to check that out.
Yeah, I bet. And it's a great interview. I mean, I've heard it a couple times. I can't recommend that book enough. I know, I mean, on the anti-imperialism site, we have a kind of recommended readings list, and we don't really get too much into China on it, but that's one of the few books that's in the China section, just because it really highlights the difference between socialism and capitalism. Even if China was a kind of poor, you know, materially poor country, it kind of just after a revolution, still kind of, you know, still hadn't really developed its productive forces and whatnot, it's still such a stark difference. And it really shows the difference in the kind of psychologies that socialism promotes as opposed to capitalism. It's not this kind of dog-eat-dog, I'm going to fuck you over so I can get mine sort of mentality that's being promoted. It's sort of, how can we work together to make things better? And, you know, if you're not working with us, how can we get you to work with us? So it's, you know, very different. And you guys have a great media archive on your website as well. All the men theories.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I would recommend people, if you haven't studied China, and you're, especially if you're new to this, you're looking for inspiration, or you want to know why we talk about China so much, you should read some of the books that we have in our archive that we link to or that we recommend, or, you know, just pick up some books by people like William Hinton, who's the author of Red Star Over China. Who's that?
Edgar Snow.
Yeah, books like that. Like, you know, these were American correspondents who went to China. Agnes Medley is another one. And it's just, you know, it's real, it's just like on-the-ground information about how things worked. And it is so different from anything that you would ever know living in our country. And I just find it so inspirational. I encourage people to check them out.
And it's, yeah, I mean, my kind of, I guess, method, like studying his background is in history, and it's kind of weird how things really get erased from history, and unless you're looking for it, you just don't learn about it. You know, it's almost like it doesn't exist, and the progressive aspects of 20th century Chinese history is definitely one of those things that gets pushed under the rug in bourgeois history. And I just wanted to throw out the name of one book. You mentioned William Hinton. Turning Point in China is a really good short one for people who are interested. And that was written during the period of the Cultural Revolution from a, you know, kind of like an outsider journalistic perspective. So it gives it, you know, has that sort of vibe. And because it was written during the time, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. So, you know, he's kind of definitely writing in the moment. But another really good one is Don Ping Hong's The Unknown Cultural Revolution. He's a Chinese national who lived through the Cultural Revolution, has a very, you know, positive, favorable view on it, writes about a lot of facets of the Cultural Revolution in a single, you know, village. So there's a lot of really great literature about China if you're really looking for it, but you just kind of have to know what you're looking for, I suppose, and, you know, get beyond the Wikipedia articles and whatnot.
Yeah, find the right books.
Yeah, definitely. And I can't stress enough how great the archive you guys have is. And I know that was kind of started to some extent by MIM whenever they had the Black Panther Party archive, which, you know, was probably at the time the largest archive of Black Panther Party material. And you kind of kept that going with, you know, a lot of the books that are available from your website, whether it's, you know, what is that book by Mass Base of Social Democracy, Labor Aristocracy, Mass Base of Social Democracy. Do you have a copy of Settlers up there?
Yep, H.W. Edwards.
Cool.
Yeah, lots of stuff on the labor aristocracy up there.
Yeah, and it's definitely an important topic. And in my opinion, I read a lot about this. It's kind of one of those things where it's, you know, Lenin was talking about this 100 years ago. I mean, this debate should have been over by, you know, 1930 at the very least. For some reason, we're still having it. And a lot of it comes down to, you know, it's easier to take the non-controversial position. It's easier to take the position that's just, you know, paraphrasing the rhetoric of the Communist Manifesto. But nonetheless, there's a lot of really great material that relates to economics. And it doesn't all, and I think one of the things that's great about your organization is just because you have this sort of analysis of classes in modern society, it doesn't really inhibit any sort of positive practice, sort of revolutionary practice from happening in the United States or elsewhere. In fact, it sort of refines that sort of practice. You know, it gives it a better analytical framework to develop out of.
Yeah, and a topic I'd like to get into if we have time that's related to that is the topic of security and the importance of security as it relates to our class analysis and looking at the conditions within a highly industrialized, highly technological imperialist society. If you want to get into that.
We got about 7 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay. So, you know, it's been in the news a lot, Edward Snowden, NSA whistleblower, releasing documents. Maybe some people have heard of lavabit.com. That was our email provider up until last year. They were shut down. Well, they actually voluntarily shut down after the federal government asked for to get backdoor access to their data. And they said, fuck you, and they shut down instead. And we respect them for that, but we lost our email access. So, There's a lot to take from this that I think it's great that it's entering the dialogue. None of this is new or surprising to those of us who studied COINTELPRO. None of the documents released by Snowden are surprising to us. But there's a it's something that NIM took up. You know, it was integral to their class analysis. So this isn't something that's new for us, but it's been such a struggle to get people to take it seriously. And I think there's kind of two big myths that a lot of activist types respond with when you start talking about security. One of them is that they already know who I am, so it doesn't matter. And the other is that worrying about security work takes away from doing real work that I need to do. So to address the first one, they already know who you are, but do they know who your new recruits are? And do you care about the safety of the new kids that you're recruiting into your organization? Do they know everything about how your organization works, and do you care about the security of your organization? The main task of the PIGS has been to create networks, and now with social networks on the internet, something that used to take them hundreds or thousands of person hours, they could just sit and basically with a push of the button, they have access to that information. So that needs to change, and the reason they want that information is to disrupt our work. So it's not just a question of knowing whether you belong to an organization. It's knowing who's doing what, when, how different people relate to each other, and using that to disrupt. And so even if you're like the most public person in the world, if you start using better security practices right now, that's going to make it harder for them to disrupt your work. Now, the idea that this security work takes away from our real work, we put out an article that you might want to check out, is Self-Defense and Secure Communications. It actually came out before the Edward Snowden leaks. Like I said, we've been talking about this for a while, but the idea that we put forth is that security work is real work. And in fact, it might be more important than a lot of things that people think are important. As people in the first world, if you accept our class analysis, one of the strengths that we have in this country is access to cutting-edge technology, and we can afford that technology. That's something that other people in the third world don't have as a strength. And something that they have as a strength is popular support, which is something that we do not have. And I would argue that using security technologies is going to eat up more person hours of the imperialists that could be used, if they have them, they could be used to oppress people in the third world, and that in doing so that we can have a greater impact than maybe some of the things that people put a lot of weight in progressive movements in this country.
Yeah, that's a good point. I had never thought about that second one before. But yeah, say the name of that article one more time just so everybody check it out.
Yeah, it's called Self-Defense and Secure Communications, and it actually gets into some specific technologies, which we haven't done in the past, but we decided that some of these they're just such obvious choices that there's no risk in saying that we use these technologies. And, you know, for people, you know, we run into people who are fans of our work a lot of the times. And I don't really understand it, but we run into people who really get excited when they find out that we're with men in prisons. But they don't want to work with us for some reason. They're intimidated, or they'd rather work with the organization that's more popular or that their friends are in. So I don't know. I like to call those people out. But as an example of something that you could do, if you don't feel like working with us, you know, I do think that working on security technology is something that contributes to our work. Even just using that technology in a lot of cases can help improve the work that we do.
Certainly. And yeah, I mean, I think we could probably spend like 2 or 3 shows talking about, you know, everyday practice that happens in the United States, but we should probably wrap it up about here. Go ahead and give people your information one more time. Let them know how they can get in contact with you, what kind of media they can find online, and anything else you'd like to let people know.
Well, we're online at prisoncensorship.info. We also have an official account on Reddit, which we set up after our email got shut down, just so we have a second place you can find us and know that we're for real. Our GPG key is on our website and on our Reddit account, so you can communicate with us securely, encrypted. Our snail mail address for prisoners, P.O. Box 40799, San Francisco, California, 94140. And, you know, Nick, I think, you know, I know this show just got started. I think you're doing a good job. I've really enjoyed listening to the programs you've had so far. I think I hope to see it be a continuing discussion. I hope it's something that we can continue to participate in.
Well, thank you very much for joining me. It's been a pleasure. And, you know, I hope everybody learned a lot and got a lot of new information that they might not have thought about before. Cool. Well, thanks a lot, Ruthann. We'll catch you next week. This is Dialectics. That's Nim Prisons. I'll talk to you later.
Good night.
Good night.